The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum of Accelerated Government Strategies, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Women of Washington is a series of weekly radio interviews with Washington, D.C.'s most ambitious and influential female executives, role models for the next generation of Washington leaders. Aileen and Gigi interview the most accomplished women in Washington who share their life lessons and secrets to success.
I'm Aileen Black.
And I'm Gigi Shum.
Today in the studio, we have Ami Hober, consultant, former Deputy Assistant Secretary for Army Research and Development, and current candidate for Maryland's 6th Congressional District. Our guest is a national security expert, business leader, and women's advocate. Appointed by President Reagan as Deputy Undersecretary of Army, Ami worked closely with the administration and Congress to strengthen Americans' defense. She oversaw the Army's research and development programs and managed the environmental cleanup of decommissioned bases. Ami also led the Pentagon's effort to protect our troops from chemical and biological weapons. Today, Ami is running for Congress in Maryland's 6th Congressional District. Ami is a graduate of Stanford University and resides in Potomac, Maryland.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to be able to speak.
Well, Ami, let's begin with your background. Virtually all of the successful women that we speak to on the show have had a significant influence on them while they were growing up, either a person or an event. What was your biggest influence when you were growing up?
Well, I have to say my parents. Both of them were professionals. I'm actually the daughter of a Roman Catholic mother and a Southern Baptist minister father, and both of them are ambitious and serious, or were ambitious and serious people. Both ended up being teachers. My father is one of the world's leading scholars on Dante. And my mother was one of the best English teachers that Santa Barbara ever had. So they imbued in all three of us daughters, and I'm the oldest, a great sense of importance of doing a real serious career.
And you must have had pretty high expectations for the reading that you did in your home as well.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I actually proofread a number of my father's manuscripts and books over the years.
You went to Stanford. Stanford is one of the top universities in the nation. Why did you pick Stanford?
I picked Stanford because I needed to get out of town, for one thing. I was the oldest and therefore well-known around town, and I couldn't get away with the thing. So my objective was to get out of town as fast as I could. But the reason why I picked Stanford was because in my day, it was the only one of the top schools that was co-ed. And I really did not want to go to a girls' school. I really wanted to have the experience of a large co-ed university.
So, Ami, what was your first job getting out of Stanford with your political science degree?
Ah, now this is fun. It came to be close to the end of my senior year. And while my parents had certainly helped support me during college, they clearly were not going to after I graduated. So I went to my favorite professor and I said, "This is all very nice and good. And how do I pay my rent next week?" And so he sent me to a place called Stanford Research Institute, which was right close by and associated with the university. And they hired me for the one job they had open at the moment, which is working on Army ballistic missile defense. Now, I had absolutely no real intention of going into military work at that point. But hey, it was a job, and I needed to write the rent check. So I went to work there and proved to be very interesting work. I did well at it. I was one of the very few women in the business, so I had the advantage of being remembered. The first conference I actually went to was 3,000 men and me. And I have to be honest, I had a great time. But it was clear that I got remembered. And so I had a number of very good male mentors over the years. But I had no female mentors because there simply weren't very many in the business. So that's one of the reasons why today I spend a lot of time mentoring young women in the defense business and in other areas. But I find it really incumbent on successful women to do that, to give the hand up to the younger generation.
So I have to ask, you know, they hired you as a 22-year-old approximate, I'm sure, grad from Stanford with a degree in political science. Why did they think you could have anything to do with ballistic missiles?
Well, they trained me. It was very good on-the-job training. It was learn this stuff and come help us with this project. And I was quite junior at that point, and so I was just sort of helping with what they needed. One of my jobs was to do plots of maps of cities, for example, where the housing was versus where, if there were a nuclear attack, the bomb would actually go off and blow down houses and kill people. And I would have great big maps of cities and plot destruction curves.
So you mentioned that you were one among many when you were being the only young woman there. Did you have trouble with them taking you seriously, being young and female and working in such a sort of male, traditionally male-dominated industry?
Sure. But I had learned, I guess, from my parents, just go ahead and do it anyhow. And sooner or later, they all ended up respecting the competence.
Speaking of your parents, you mentioned that in your family, you're one of three daughters.
Right.
Both Gigi and I come from a family of all girls. And we have commented, a couple of our guests have commented, that our parents maybe didn't have a chance to treat us differently than boys versus girls. And we believe that has contributed to the makeup of us, that we saw things as gray and we were expected to do whatever to get the job done. Do you believe that has affected your fabric of who you are today?
Oh, absolutely. The other thing that really has affected it, though, is the fact that I'm the oldest of the three. And any good shrink would tell you that I'm clearly an oldest child. You do get the slight dominance of that. I mean, I am still in a position, I adore my sisters, but it's no question that I can dominate if I choose to. And that's always been true.
So what advice would you give to daughters, parents, I'm sorry, raising daughters today to help instill that strong sense of self and determination?
I don't know exactly how one does it. I think a large part of it is example. My mother always worked very hard. As I said, she was a teacher and a very good teacher. My father worked hard too, but it was more that men were expected to in that generation. I don't think a lot of women actually expected to have serious careers back at that point. And so simply the example of my mother having a serious career helped a lot.
Today in the studio, we have Ami Hober, consultant and former Deputy Assistant Secretary for Army Research and Development, and current candidate for Maryland's 6th Congressional District. Coming up, we'll hear about Ami's years at the Pentagon. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Today in the studio, we have Ami Hober, consultant and former Deputy Assistant Secretary for Army Research and Development and current candidate for Maryland's 6th Congressional District.
So, Ami, you have authored or co-authored numerous books and articles on chemical warfare, military strategy, Soviet military doctrine, U.S. defense policy options, including pieces like The Chemistry of Defeat, Conventional War and Escalation, Soviet Strategy for Nuclear War, The Soviet View of Deterrence, The Neglected Threat of Chemical Warfare. My goodness, that is unique by any standards in any day and age. But for a woman in the 80s and 90s, it's absolutely unique. So how did you find the passion? You mentioned that you sort of got into defense by accident. How did you find the passion to do it and to be so prominent in that field?
Well, I kept working at it. As I said earlier, I started out in ballistic missile defense, essentially working for the Army. Went on from there, came back to Washington, worked for a small Air Force firm called Analytic Services. It was essentially a short-term spinoff of the RAND Corporation. I got involved in looking at threats to the U.S. and how we would counter them. When I went to the RAND Corporation, I worked with some of the great nuclear strategists of the day, Albert Wohlstetter, Herman Kahn, those sorts of people, and learned a lot about how to think about strategy, and then got into looking at the Soviet Union. There are some great stories there. The chemical warfare thing, again, was another accident, and I've done mostly on-the-job training in that business. What happened there was I went to a friend of mine in the Pentagon at that point, Andrew Marshall, who is known as the Yoda of the Pentagon, and told him I was back in Washington. I had worked with him at RAND. Told him I was back in Washington and wanted to find some interesting things to do. So he sent me off to go look at unconventional threats in Europe. The standard threat that was being used at that point was the Soviets marching with all their tanks through the Fulda Gap, you know, blah, 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 to take over territory, etc. And so Andy said, go see if there are other interesting things. And I ran across a whole set of documents on chemical warfare capabilities of the Soviet Union and their strategies for using chemical weapons. And I discovered that basically no one had ever read them. No one had ever sat down to do a detailed look at what the other side was thinking. Now, there in 1968, I believe it was, there was the Dugway sheep accident out in Dugway, Utah, where there was an apparent release of nerve agent from an Air Force test plane before it should have released, and it killed 7,000 sheep. And so at that point, the U.S. research on chemical warfare and deterrence was stopped and has been stopped ever since. But that led to complacency and our stopping to think about chemical threats. And so the resurgence of my research on that really brought it back to the attention of the military, which is, I think, something that was really important at that point in time.
Absolutely. It's amazing when you think back to think that we would have thought that just because we had stopped doing that research, that everybody else would have stopped doing that research and testing as well.
Of course. And that's an interesting reflection, and it leads to lots of other sorts of things. The U.S. tends to do what is called mirror imaging. If we think something shouldn't be done, then we assume everyone else thinks something shouldn't be done. And we can get into that with the Iran agreement, for example. When the U.S. agrees to stand down on something, we tend to assume that other people will do the same thing. And that's in many cases not accurate.
Yeah, I think that's sort of you talk about strategy, at the most basic, to assume that everybody looks at the world and thinks the way that you do is pretty naive.
Right, right, right.
So talk about the dynamics of working in that business at that time. Did you have mentors? You mentioned that you never had female mentors because there weren't any. Did you have male mentors who were important to you and helped you along your career?
Yes, I had a number of male mentors that were very important to me, some in government, some at the RAND Corporation, some at ANSWER earlier, some at the company that I worked at after RAND, which is System Planning Corporation here in Roslyn, before I got the Pentagon appointment. I mean, one of the reasons why I was tagged by the Reagan administration for that job was because I had worked with and known a number of the people that Reagan had on his campaign defense team and in the Pentagon transition team. And they were all fabulous people. And when they called me and asked if I would go to work for the Reagan administration, I thought, you know, this is going to be a very interesting time. And it was.
Sounds like some of them were not only mentors to you, but also sponsors. We talk a lot about the difference between mentorship and sponsorship.
Right. And a lot of them were both. And a lot of them were also friends. I mean, my tendency is to make friends with the people I work with. And, you know, one develops a relationship that blends all of those.
So what was your role? What was your mission in the Pentagon?
Well, the key mission was to run the Army's R&D budget allocation. I had, $4 or $5 billion a year that walked across my desk that I could actually help allocate. And I was told by one of my mentors, go find a program to start and go find a program to kill. And I tried to do both of those. The one that I started was a heavy lift helicopter program, which actually died about 2 weeks after I left my job. But that wasn't a surprise. I actually got it started and made some progress. The one I tried to kill, which I won't name, I had fun with the Army with, because I would try and kill it. And then every year it would pop up someplace else in the budget under a different name. And by the end of my time there, it almost got to be a game. It was, can Ms. Hober find it this year? And that's what I mean about making friends and being comfortable with people. I mean, I liked the Army guys I worked with. I truly did. And I think they truly liked me, and they knew that, you know, I had their best interests at heart, and I would work hard for it. But we also had our fun little things like that. The day they put me in a chemical warfare suit and sent me into the live agent training, I actually sat there and worked with nerve agent in the live agent training facility at Fort McClellan, probably the only civilian female that ever went through that training. And these were amazing experiences, but they're bonding experiences. And I think you not only have to have mentors and sponsorships, you have to bond with people.
Now, in the 80s, there couldn't have been too many women in the Pentagon, especially at the executive level you were at. So what was it like being a woman?
There were a few others. There were probably three or four of us at that sort of level, and we got to be friends, and we would have lunch together and talk about it. And knowing that there were a few other women was very helpful. If there had been none, I think I would have been more uncomfortable. But in general, after I got through the first month and proved to the guys that I really did know what I was doing and I really was there to help them, it all worked out fine. I never had another day where I felt I was being discriminated against.
Do you think it's changed a lot in the last 30 years? Certainly the number of women at the executive level has increased a little bit.
Increased markedly. And I think that's a good thing. And I think the acceptance of women has been very, very much improved. I think there are still some bastions of, shall we say, male chauvinism. The Marine Corps is not terribly happy with the mixed sex units, but this will ease off over time. And I think it is clear that women in the military have to meet the standards for any particular job. But I think they're proving that the ones that do meet the standards do an excellent job.
Today in the studio, we have Ami Hober, consultant and former Deputy Assistant Secretary for Army Research and Development and current candidate for Maryland's 6th Congressional District. Ami, before we go to break, I just have to ask, you broke through so many barriers, and even though you weren't in the military yourself, worked so closely, and when you were talking about your experience with the live nerve gas and then meeting standards, you know, just recently we've had the first group of women pass the Army Ranger training. And what do you think about that as you look back on your career and you see sort of what the women today are doing?
I think that's wonderful. If I were still in the Pentagon, the first thing I do is ask them to come in and see me just so I could meet them. I mean, I think that's absolutely fabulous. It's a change from the old days where we used to have, real problems integrating women. I do have a story on that if we've got time for it. When I was in my Pentagon job, I once got a letter from a young chemical female officer. I don't know, she wasn't chemical. A young female officer who was stationed in Europe, who sent me a letter saying that they didn't have any showers for the women. I mean, no showers. The men's showers were out in the open fields, and this was fine. But they had no showers that had any sort of privacy where the women were at all comfortable. And so it took me a little while, but I finally got her a shower. I got it ordered and sent over there. And she and I are still friends to this day.
So sometimes you were working on important strategic national policy, and other times you were getting showers in Europe.
Exactly.
Today in the studio, we have Ami Hober, consultant and former Deputy Assistant Secretary for Army Research and Development and current candidate for Maryland's 6th Congressional District. Coming up, we'll ask Ami about women in politics. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Today in the studio, we have Ami Hober, consultant and former Deputy Assistant Secretary for Army and Research and Development and current candidate for Maryland's 6th Congressional District. Ami, I got to take a step back before we talk about women in politics and ask you something based on where we ended our last conversation. There is currently an Iranian nuclear arms agreement that is being discussed in Congress. One of Ronald Reagan's main approaches with the Soviets during the close of the Cold War was trust but verify. And with your level of expertise and some of the research that you've done in the Soviets, and especially in light of the recent world events, which have to do with the Soviets, in this case, the buildup in Serbia, do you think that this legislation is taking the right speed and direction in the right approach for the times that we live in today?
I'm not at all happy with the Iran agreement. First off, it is an agreement, not a treaty, however, so that gives the next administration at least the possibility of overruling it and tearing it up, as some of the candidates have said. But I think it goes right to the heart of the Reagan approach on trust but verify. First off, I'm not quite willing to trust the Iranians. They run up and down their streets saying death to America. We are the great Satan, all of that sort of stuff. But even then, we don't know how we can verify this. The verification regime is a separate agreement between Iran and the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna, and we have not even read that. This is a piece of paper that is not being given to the Congress, in contrary to the law that was signed about 6 months ago that said we would only agree to this if all pieces of it went in front of Congress. And so we are essentially asking the Congress to vote on something they can't read. And I mean, I have never signed a contract that I haven't read. And I think asking Congress to do that is a serious mistake, and I think we will live to regret it.
So how would we, mid-course, or as far as we are down the course, how would we change that now? What would be the process to incorporate that document into what they have to read?
Well, the IAEA won't release it, so there isn't any way that Congress can read it. Unless the IAEA changes its practices, it doesn't release any independent agreements. This is actually not part of the negotiated agreement with the United States. And so I don't know that there's a way to solve this problem. I would reject the agreement out of hand unless we have adequate access to the verification regime details.
So it sounds like it's trust but not verify.
It's trust but not verify, and you're trusting somebody that says they want to destroy you. And I find that a very uncomfortable place to be.
I mean, we're going to shift complete directions now.
All right.
In the election cycle coming up, getting the women's vote is going to be important, whether that be at the national level for the president or whether that be in local elections. Women still represent single digits in terms of leadership positions in our boardrooms and executive positions in the Fortune 100 and in the federal government. There is still the pay gap, women earning about 78 cents on the dollar for every man. So what do you think needs to be done to, first of all, kind of change these facts, but then secondly, have women better represented and have the politicians paying attention to the women's vote and how important it is?
Well, I think we've made a lot of progress, actually. I was one of the founders of the Women's Political Caucus in Los Angeles. I was one of the founders of the Women's Political Caucus in Virginia. And I've chaired both of those at various points in the past. Those fought very hard to get more women active in the political arena, and I think in general have succeeded. There are more women at the lower levels of government, at the local levels, even in more in the state levels around the country than there were a couple of decades ago. And so I think it's going in the right direction. It's just going very slowly for a lot of reasons that have to do with economics, that have to do with women essentially being responsible for their homes and their children much more than men. Although I'm actually finding the current generation, the men are much more involved in homes and children. My son spends as much time raising the grandson as his wife does. They're both totally committed to that. I think that's a fabulous change in focus.
I think you're right that you not only have to think about how to get more women into executive positions and boardrooms, but you have to think about who's going to be doing the work that
right.
they traditionally have done at home. So when we're talking about politics, though, the front runner still on the Republican side of the presidential candidate is still Donald Trump. And
right.
it seems that as much as people talk about the women's vote being important, he takes pretty much every opportunity he has to insult some woman or the other. I think most notably Carly Fiorina, although she had a pretty good comeback to him during the debate. So can you talk a little bit about the importance of the women's vote during this election cycle?
Well, remember, women are the majority in this country. Women are now over 51% of the population. They're still not quite 51% of the voting population. The vote turnout is not quite as good as it ought to be. But I think one of the things that Trump has done in this election cycle is get people to pay more attention. And I'm hoping that that will include women as well as men. And the more we pay attention, the more likely we are to get the women's impact felt.
You know, at the last debate for the Republican candidates, they were each asked what woman they admire. But for the majority, could not name an American, number one. Many of them named some great women in history, but they weren't Americans, that really made a difference on our landscape. A couple came to mind for me right away. So how do we change that in the thought process of our candidates and our voters to see women as being viable candidates for positions like the President of the United States?
We need to keep on promoting the women who do have competence. We need to keep on electing the women who show competence, not necessarily trading just on their gender, but trading on their proven ability, their experience, their range of competencies. I commonly say I will feel that women have really made it when mediocre women do as well as mediocre men. But it's also true that we want the sterling women to do as well as the sterling men. And so we have to have essentially an equal promotion probability for women based on competence in both business and politics.
Now, you mentioned you were past chair and co-founder of the National Women's Political Caucus chapters, both in Northern Virginia and L.A. First, can you tell us what that organization is about and what it does?
It's primarily an organization that promotes women candidates. There are a number of other functions that it does, but it is primarily for the promotion of female candidates at all levels. It is more a Democratic group than a Republican group, but there is a significant Republican component there. And as a matter of fact, one of my best friends was the first Republican chair, national chair of the Women's Political Caucus. And so its real focus is to identify women in the political arena and help mentor them to run for office, to run for higher office, to support other candidates actively. This sort of thing.
One of the biggest challenges I've read for women running for office is funding.
Absolutely. Getting people to donate, contribute to campaigns is hard for both men and women candidates. And that's a major problem. The women in this country don't necessarily control as much of the wealth that can be expended for such things as campaigns as the men do. And so it's harder to generate a significant amount of contributions.
Today in the studio, we have Ami Hober, consultant and former Deputy Assistant Secretary for Army Research and Development and current candidate for Maryland's 6th Congressional District. Coming up, we'll ask Ami about how she balances it all. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today in the studio, we have Ami Hober, consultant and former Deputy Assistant Secretary for Army Research and Development and current candidate for Maryland's 6th Congressional District.
So, Ami, in the last segment, we were talking about women in leadership positions and women in politics and running for office. And we were talking about how important it was to have competent women go for those roles. But when women are, whether it be in a political arena or in a organization, sometimes if they are strong and competent, people spend more time focusing on their hairstyle or their wardrobe or, you know, I think about on both sides of the aisle, Hillary Clinton, every time she changes a hairstyle, it becomes a subject of national debate. And we talked earlier about Carly Fiorina and, you know, Donald Trump mentioning, you know, the way that she looks. And how do women deal with this perception issue?
That's really a tough one. You're not going to fool anyone on your gender. You are, in fact, a female, and that's the way it is. But that shouldn't be a detraction. I think there's a way to balance being feminine and being professional. That's hard to find, but I think once you find your style for that, you sort of stick with it. And in that sense, I think Hillary has done it well. In that sense, she now has got her hair under control, and she wears a certain style of clothing that suits her, and she's very stable with that. And I think she's found a good identity for her that way.
I heard you say that you have been successful in business beyond your dreams.
And absolutely.
That, for a woman, that is also unique.
Yes.
According to the Kauffman Foundation, a nonprofit on education, between 2004 and 2007, women founded only about 3% of technology firms. And, you know, the numbers aren't going in the right direction, whether it be at the executive level or in starting businesses. How, in your opinion, can we help start flipping these statistics to help women get the idea and the confidence to start a business and then to help them be successful?
I don't even think one needs confidence. I certainly did not have confidence when I started out. It was like jumping off a cliff. And I figured, well, okay, if it doesn't work, I can always go look for a job. But it's not so much confidence as it is guts, as it is willingness to take a serious risk, a willingness to put yourself out there. And you do have to think about the implications for your family. At that point, I was a single mom, and I had a kid to put through college. And it was important that I do whatever I had to do to get him through college properly first, and then I was free to take a fling and try it. And like I said, I've been successful. But I think the whole culture of work is changing. I think we are getting to what some people have termed a gig economy, where you can work for yourself and coalesce with other people who work for themselves in small cadres to do particular projects. And that's essentially what my small business is. It's gathering together groups of people to do particular projects. We work on things like border security in Eastern Europe, arms control, arms dismantlement in other countries, chemical weapons cleanup in countries. We work on specific individual projects, and I have a network of experts that I pull together for whatever project it is. And we all know each other and we all work this way. And it's an Uber economy.
Recently, in the last year, the rules have changed a little bit for women businesses for the federal government, too.
Right.
They have now gotten the status where they're kind of on equal par with small disadvantaged businesses. So it's never been a better time for a woman to start a business, especially in supporting the federal arena. And what advice would you have for maybe a woman out there listening right now who's thinking about starting a business?
I would go for it. If you can possibly take the risk, I'd go for it. Now, two specific pieces of advice. First off, decide what you want to make in terms of money, okay? And I call, in sense of paying your monthly bills, okay? You have so many bills, you have to pay them. That's what I call the minimum. And once you make that minimum every month, you must stop worrying. You aren't allowed to worry until the first of the next month. Otherwise, you drive yourself totally bananas with stress. And that was one of my original rules so that I could relax a little. The other rule is don't start the business until you have two potential clients. One is not enough. You might as well be an employee if you only have one client. But if you have two, then you're on your own and you can go for it. And the third really is market every minute until you get established. I mean, market at the grocery store when you run into somebody, market at every opportunity of conferences and seminars. When you're walking down the street and see a friend, tell them what you're doing and ask them who they know who might be interested in using your technology or your services. But those are the three basic rules. And then have a cadre of friends, particularly for women. Having your women's group of supporters is fabulous and makes a world of difference. I know in my early days, I had a group of women and we would meet every Friday night and split a couple of bottles of wine. And it was just a relief. It was people who knew who you were and you could let your hair down and get some relief from the stress of working hard all week.
So, Ami, you have had incredible success, as we've talked about. You've got a family. You've mentioned your son and a grandchild. And you've been active in so many different things. So I need to ask you the work-life balance question. How have you made it all work? How have you balanced everything?
Well, my standard comment is with a lot of hysterics and juggling. But I have found my own things that I do that are outside of work that refresh me. I blow glass as a hobby. And I have even told my campaign staff I need one afternoon a month when I blow glass, otherwise I won't be sane. This is my artistic thing of the moment. I've done art stuff all my life, but I've only done the glass blowing for the last decade. My husband and I do competitive ballroom dancing. We've been doing that for a lot of years, and we're actually pretty good. It's fun. We don't actually compete because we're never that well organized, but we do at that level. I do other things that are, you know, fun and refreshing. I exercise a lot. I like to cook and entertain. So I have enough other things so that it's not a total stress environment.
So I've heard about a lot of different hobbies on the show, but blowing glass, I think that's the first time I've heard of that one. What sort of things do you make?
I make vases. I make vases, bowls, big platters. I've done all sorts of things, all sorts of pretty bowls mostly. I give them away for charity auctions, for example. I do that sort of thing because we finally built in our basement one room that is my gallery where I have glass shelves and lighting and I put up all my glass. But I give them away as much as I can for reasonable causes because otherwise the gallery is going to get just overrun.
And so how did you get started doing that?
From the MIT Glass Lab. Mark is an MIT graduate, and he's actually on the MIT corporate board at this point. But there's a glass lab at MIT that was originally started to allow the students to blow glass for their chemistry experiments. But they have turned it into also a fun glass blowing thing. And every year they make a bunch of pumpkins and put them out on the lawn and sell them as a fundraiser. And one year when my grandson was very small, he's now 13, I bought him one of the pumpkins. And then I thought, I'm an artist part-time. I'd like to learn how to do that. And so I've been doing that now for more than a decade. And actually, the grandson blows glass with me. He's been blowing glass with me since he was 7, and he loves it.
Ami, I have one question for you. I really enjoyed our conversation today. What an amazing journey you've been on. But I got to tell you, if you were to go back into your younger self, going across that stage there at Stanford, what three pieces of advice would you give her to help her achieve the results in your career that you have, or maybe even beyond that?
The main advice I would give to a younger me or to any younger woman is realize that life is a series of accidents. And the real trick to success, in my view, is recognizing an opportunity when it walks by. And once you recognize it, then you can think about whether you want to take it or not.
Ami, I want to thank you so much for sharing your background and your insights with us. Today in the studio, we've been talking with Ami Hober, consultant and former Deputy Assistant Secretary for Army Research and Development and current candidate for Maryland's 6th Congressional District. I'm Gigi Shum.
I'm Aileen Black.
Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Women of Washington on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.